was about my wife. There had been no marital rift, he reiterated. No dope, no orgies. His wife had been beautiful and a good person, and the last few years I spent with her were the only time of true happiness in my life. Some of the reporters were less than sympathetic to Polanski's complaints about publicity, having just learned that he had permitted Life to take exclusive photos of the murder scene. Not quite exclusive. Before the magazine reached the stands, several of the Polaroid prints appeared in the Hollywood Citizen News. Life had been scooped by its own photographs. There were some things Polanski did not tell the press, or even his closest friends. One was that he had agreed to be polygraphed by the Los Angeles Police Department. Polanski's polygraph examination was conducted by Lieutenant Earl Deemer at Parker Center. Question. Mind if I call you Roman? My name is Earl. Answer. Sure. I will lie one or two times during it, and I will tell you after, okay? Question. Well, all right. Deemer asked Roman how he first met his wife. Polanski sighed, then slowly began talking. I first met Sharon 4 years ago at some kind of party Marty Rantzehoff, a terrible Hollywood producer, had. The guy who makes Beverly Hillbillies and all kinds of shit. But he seduced me with his talk about art, and I contracted with him to do this film, a spoof on the vampires, you know. And I met Sharon at the party. She was doing another film for him in London at the time, staying in London alone. Rantzehoff said, "Wait until you see our leading lady, Sharon Tate." I thought she was quite pretty, but I wasn't at that time very impressed. But then I saw her again. I took her out. We talked a lot, you know. At that time, I was really swinging. All I was interested in was to fuck a girl and move on. I had a very bad marriage, you know, years before. Not bad, it was beautiful, but my wife dumped me, so I was really feeling great because I was a success with women and I just liked fucking around. I was a swinger, huh? So I met her a couple of more times. I knew she was with Jay. Then Rantzehoff wanted me to use her in the film, and I made tests with her. Once before I wanted to take her out, and she was being difficult, wanting to go out, not wanting to go out, so I said, "Fuck you," and I hung up. Probably that was the beginning of everything, you know. Question. You sweet-talked her. Answer. Right. She got intrigued by me. And I really played it cool, and it took me long dating before. And then I started seeing that she liked me. I remember I spent a night, I lost a key, and I spent a night in her house in the same bed, you know. And I knew there was no question of making love with her. That's the type of girl she was. I mean, that rarely happens to me. And then we went on location. It was about 2 or 3 months later. When we were on location shooting the film, I asked her, "Would you like to make love with me?" And she said very sweetly, "Yes." And then for the first time, I was somewhat touched by her, you know. And we started sleeping regularly together. And she was so sweet and so lovely that I didn't believe it, you know. I'd had bad experiences, and I didn't believe that people like that existed. And I was waiting a long time for her to show the color, right? But she was beautiful. Without this phoniness. She was fantastic. She loved me. I was living in a different house. I didn't want her to come to my house, and she would say, "I don't want to smother you. I only want to be with you," etc. And I said, "You know how I am. I screw around." And she said, "I don't want to change you." And she was ready to do everything just to be with me. She was a fucking angel. She was a unique character, who I'll never meet again in my life. Deemer asked about his first meeting with Sebring. It had occurred in a London restaurant, Polanski said, describing how nervous he had been, and how Jay had broken the ice by saying, "I dig you, man, I dig you." More important, he seemed happy to see Sharon happy. Roman had remained slightly uncomfortable through their next several meetings. But when I came to Los Angeles, started living here, he came to our parties, etc. And I started liking Jay very, very much. He was a very sweet person. Oh, I know of his hang-ups. He liked to whip tie girls. Sharon told me about it. He tied her once to the bed, and she told me about it, and was making fun of him. To her it was funny, but sad. And he was more and more often a guest of ours. He would just hang around, and sometimes Sharon would resent his staying too long, because he was always the last to leave, you know. I'm sure in the beginning of our relationship there was still his love for Sharon, but I think that largely it disappeared. I'm quite sure. Question. So there was no indication that Sharon went back to Sebring at any time? Answer. Not a chance. I'm the bad one. I always screw around. That was Sharon's big hang-up, you know. But Sharon was absolutely not interested in Jay. Question. Was she interested in any other men? Answer. No. There was not a chance of any other man getting close to Sharon. Question. Okay. I know you have to get on your way. We might as well start. I'll tell you how this works, Roman. Deemer explained the mechanics of the polygraph, adding, It's important for you to remain quiet. I know you talk a lot with your hands. You're emotional. You're an actor-type person, so it's going to be a little difficult for you. But when the pressure is on, I want you to remain quiet. When it's off, you can talk and even wave your arms. Within reason. After instructing Polanski to confine his answers to yes and no, and to save any explanations for later, Deemer began the interrogation. Question. Do you have a valid California driver's license? Answer. Yes. Question. Have you eaten lunch today? Answer. No. Question. Do you know who took the life of Wojtek and the others? Answer. No. Question. Do you smoke cigarettes? Answer. Yes. There was a long pause. Then Polanski began laughing. Question. You know what you were going to do with that screwing around? I'm going to have to start over again. Answer. Sorry. Question. Look at the increase in your blood pressure when you start to lie about your cigarettes. Boom, 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 just like a staircase. Okay, let's start over again. Are you now in Los Angeles? Answer. Yes. Question. Did you have anything to do with taking the life of Wojtek and the others? Answer. No. Question. Have you eaten lunch today? Answer. No. Question. Do you feel any responsibility for the death of Wojtek and the others? Answer. Yes. I feel responsible that I wasn't there, that is all. Question. From running this thing through your mind repeatedly, as I know you must have, who have you come up with as the target? I don't think it ever crossed your mind that Sharon might be the target, that anyone had that kind of mad on for her. Is there anyone else who was up there that you can think of who would be a target for this type of activity? Answer. I've thought everything. I thought the target could be myself. Question. Why? Answer. I mean, it could be some kind of jealousy or plot or something. It couldn't be Sharon directly. If Sharon were the target, it would mean that I was the target. It could be Jay was the target. It could be Wojtek. It could also be sheer folly. Someone just decided to commit a crime. Question. What would Sebring be doing, for instance, that would make him a target? Answer. Some money thing, maybe. I've also heard a lot about this drug thing, drug deliveries. It's difficult for me to believe. Polanski had always believed Sebring to be a rather prosperous man, yet he'd recently heard he had large debts. The indication to me is that he must have been in serious financial trouble, despite the appearances he gave. Question. That's a hell of a way to collect debts. It's no ordinary bill collector that goes up there and kills five people. Answer. No, no. What I'm talking about is, for this reason, he might have got into some dangerous areas to make money, you understand? In desperation, he may have got mixed up with illegal people, you know? Question. Eliminating Sharon and the kid, of the three remaining, you think that Sebring would be the logical target, huh? Answer. The whole crime seems so illogical. If I'm looking for a motive, I'd look for something which doesn't fit your habitual standard, with which you used to work as police. Something much more far out. Deemer asked Polanski if he had received any hate mail after Rosemary's baby. He admitted he had, surmising it could be some type of witchcraft, you know, a maniac or something. This execution, this tragedy, indicates to me it must be some kind of nut, you know. I wouldn't be surprised if I were the target, in spite of all this drug thing, the narcotics. I think the police like to jump too hastily on this type of lead, you know, because it is their usual kind of lead. The only connection I know of Wojtek with any kind of narcotic was he smoked pot. So did Jay, plus cocaine. I knew he was sniffing. In the beginning, I thought it was just an occasional kick. When I discussed it with Sharon, she said, "Are you kidding? He's been doing it for 2 years regularly." Question. Did Sharon mess with narcotics to any extent other than pot? Answer. No. She did take LSD before we met, many times. And when we met, we discussed it. I took it 3 times. When it was legal, he added, laughing. Then, serious again, Polanski recalled the only time they had taken it together. It was toward the end of 1965. It was his 3rd trip and Sharon's 15th or 16th. It had begun pleasantly enough with them talking all night, but then, in the morning, she started flipping out and screaming, and I was scared to death. And after that, she said, "I told you I couldn't take it, and this is the end." And it was the end, for me and for her. But I can tell you this without question. She took no drugs at all, except for pot, and not too much. And during her pregnancy, there was no question. She was so in love with her pregnancy, she would do nothing. I'd pour a glass of wine, and she wouldn't touch it. Once more, Deemer took him through the questioning, then ended the examination, satisfied that Roman Polanski had no involvement in, or any hidden knowledge of, the murder of his wife and the others. Before leaving, Roman told him, "I'm devoted now to this thing." He intended to question even his friends. "But I'm going to do it slowly so they don't get suspicious. No one knows I'm here. I don't want them to know that I'm trying in any way to help the police, you know. I'm hoping in this way they'll have more sincerity." Question. "You have to go on living." Polanski thanked him, lighted a cigarette, and left. Question. "Hey, I thought you didn't smoke cigarettes." But Polanski had already gone. On August 20th, 3 days after Peter Hercos accompanied Roman Polanski to the Cielo residence, a picture of Hercos appeared in the Citizen News. It was captioned, "Famed psychic. Peter Hercos, famed for his consultation in murder cases, including the current Sharon Tate massacre, opens Friday night at the Huntington Hartford, appearing through August 30th. Madigan and Jones had been eliminated as suspects. Wilson and Pickett remained. Because of his familiarity with the case, it was decided to send Lieutenant Deemer east to interview the two. Jeffrey "Pick" Pickett had been contacted through a relative, and a meeting was set up in a Washington, D.C. hotel room. The son of a prominent State Department official, Pickett appeared to Deemer to be under the influence of some narcotic, probably an excitant drug. He also had a bandaged hand. When Deemer expressed curiosity about it, Pickett vaguely replied that he had cut it on a kitchen knife. Though he agreed to a polygraph, Deemer found that Pickett couldn't remain still or follow instructions, so he interviewed him informally. He claimed that on the day of the murders he had been working in an auto company in Sheffield, Massachusetts. Asked if he owned any weapons, he admitted he had a buck knife, purchased, he said, in Marlborough, Massachusetts, on a friend's credit card. Later, Pickett gave Deemer the knife. It was similar to the one found at Cielo. He also turned over a roll of videotape which he claimed showed Abigail Folger and Wojtek Frykowski using drugs at a party at the Tate residence. Pickett didn't say how he came into possession of the film or what use he had intended to make of it. Accompanied by Sergeant McGann, Deamer went to Massachusetts. A check of the time cards at the auto company in Sheffield revealed that Pickett's last workday was August 1st. 8 days before the homicides. Moreover, though two stores in Marlborough sold Buck knives, neither had ever stocked this particular model. Pickett's status as a suspect rose appreciably until the detectives interviewed the friend he had mentioned. Going through his credit card receipts, he produced the one for the Buck knife. It had been purchased in Sudbury, Massachusetts, on August 21st, long after the murders. The friend and his wife also recalled something Pickett had apparently forgotten. He had gone to the beach with them the weekend of August 8th through 10th. Pickett was subsequently polygraphed twice. Both times it was decided he was telling the truth and was not involved. Eliminate Pickett. Flying to Toronto, Deamer interviewed Herb Wilson. Although initially reluctant to submit to a polygraph, Wilson consented when Deamer agreed not to ask any questions that might make him liable to Canadian prosecution on narcotics charges. He passed. Eliminate Wilson. The fingerprints of both Pickett and Wilson were checked against the unmatched Tate latents, with no match. Although the first Tate investigative report, covering the period August 9 through 31, concluded that Wilson, Madigan, Pickett, and Jones have been eliminated at the time of this report, in early September, Deamer and McGann flew to Ocho Rios, Jamaica, to check out the alibis of Wilson and Jones. The pair claimed they had been there from July 8th until August 17th, making a movie about marijuana. Interviews with realtors, servants, and airline ticket agencies supported half their story. They had been in Jamaica at the time of the murders, and it was quite possible they did have something to do with marijuana. Their only regular visitor, excluding female friends, was a pilot who, a few weeks before, had without explanation quit his well-paying job with a leading airline to make unscheduled solo runs between Jamaica and the United States. As for their movie-making, however, the detectives evinced some skepticism, the maid having told them the only camera she ever saw in the house was a small Kodak. The videotape Pickett gave Deamer was viewed in the SID lab. It was decidedly different from the one previously found in the loft. Apparently filmed during the period the Polanskis were away, it showed Abigail Folger, Wojtek Frykowski, Witold K., and an unidentified young lady having dinner in front of the fireplace of the Tate residence. The video machine was simply turned on and left to run, those present after a time seeming to forget it. Abigail wore her hair tied back in a rather severe chignon effect. She looked both older and more tired than in her other photos. Wojtek looked dissipated. Though what appeared to be marijuana was smoked, Wojtek seemed more drunk than high. At first, Abigail treated him with the exasperated affection one would accord a spoiled child. But then the mood gradually changed. In an obvious attempt to exclude Abigail, Wojtek began speaking Polish. Abigail, in turn, was playing the grande dame, responding to his crude jests with witty repartee. Wojtek began calling her Lady Folger, then, as he became drunker, Lady F. Abigail talked about him in the third person, as if he wasn't present, commenting upon, with some disgust, his habit of coming down off his drug trips by getting drunk. To those viewing the tape, it must have seemed nothing more than an overly long, exceedingly boring chronicle of a domestic argument. Except for two incidents, which, considering what would happen to two of those present in this very house, gave it an eeriness as chilling as anything in Rosemary's Baby. As she was serving the dinner, Abigail recalled a time when Wojtek, stoned on drugs, looked into the fireplace and saw a strange shape. He had rushed for a camera, hoping to capture the image, a blazing pig's head. The second incident was, in its own way, even more disturbing. The microphone had been left on the table next to the roast. As the meat was being carved, it picked up, amazingly loud, over and over and over again, the sound of the knife grating on the bone. Herkos was not the only expert to volunteer a solution to the Tate homicides. On August 27th, Truman Capote appeared on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show to discuss the crime. One person, acting alone, had committed the murders, the author of In Cold Blood said authoritatively. He then proceeded to tell how and why. The killer, a man, had been in the house earlier. Something had happened to trigger a kind of instant paranoia. The man then left the premises, went home to get a knife and a gun, and returned to systematically assassinate everyone in the place. According to Capote's deductions, Stephen Parent was the last to die. From the knowledge accumulated in over 100 interviews with convicted murderers, Capote revealed that the killer was a very young, enraged paranoid. While committing the murders, he probably experienced a sexual release, then exhausted, went home and slept for 2 days. Although Capote had taken up the single suspect theory, the Tate detectives had by now abandoned it. Their sole reason for adopting it in the first place, Gerritsen, was no longer a factor. Because of the number of victims, the location of their bodies, and the use of two or more weapons, they were now convinced that at least two suspects were involved. Killers, plural. But as to their identity, they had not the slightest idea. At the end of August, there was a summing up for both the Tate and the LaBianca detectives. The first homicide investigation progress report, Tate, ran to 33 pages. Nowhere in it was there any mention of the LaBianca murders. The first homicide investigation progress report, LaBianca, was 17 pages long. Despite the many similarities between the two crimes, it contained not one reference to the Tate homicides. They remained two totally separate investigations. Although Lieutenant Bob Helder had over a dozen detectives working full-time on the Tate case, Sergeants Michael McGann, Robert Calkins, and Jess Buckles were the principal investigators. All were longtime veterans on the force, having worked their way up to the status of detective the hard way, from the ranks. They could remember when there was no police academy, and seniority was more important than education and merit examinations. They were experienced and inclined to be set in their ways. The LaBianca team under Lieutenant Paul LePage consisted, at various times, of from 6 to 10 detectives, with Sergeants Frank Patchett, Manuel Gutierrez, Michael Nielsen, Philip Sartucci, and Gary Broda the principal investigators. The LaBianca detectives were generally younger, better educated, and far less experienced. Graduates of the police academy, for the most part, they were more inclined to the use of modern investigative techniques. For example, they obtained the fingerprints of almost everyone they interviewed, gave more polygraph examinations, made more modus operandi, MO, and fingerprint runs through the California State Bureau of Criminal Investigation and Identification, CII, and dug deeper into the backgrounds of the victims, even checking the outgoing calls Lino LaBianca had made from a motel while on vacation 7 years ago. They were also more inclined to consider far-out theories. For example, while the Tate report didn't attempt to explain that bloody word on the front door, the LaBianca report speculated as to the meaning of the writings found inside the residence on Waverly Drive. It even suggested a connection so remote it couldn't even be called a wild guess. The report noted, investigation revealed that the singing group The Beatles' most recent album, number SWBO101, has songs titled Helter Skelter and Piggies and Blackbird. The words in the song Blackbird frequently say, arise, arise, which might be the meaning of rise near the front door. The idea was just sort of tossed in, by whom no one would later remember, and just as promptly forgotten. The two sets of detectives had one thing in common, however. Though to date the LaBianca team had interviewed some 150 persons, the Tate investigators more than twice that, neither was much closer to solving the case than when the bodies were first discovered. The Tate report listed 5 suspects: Gerritsen, Wilson, Madigan, Pickett, and Jones, all of whom had by this time been eliminated. The LaBianca report listed 15, but included Frank and Suzanne Struthers, Joe Dorgan, and numerous others who were never serious suspects. Of the 15, only Gardner remained a good possible, and though lacking a palm print for positive elimination, one had been found on a bank deposit slip on Leno's desk, his fingerprints had already been checked against those found in the residence, with no match. The progress reports were strictly intradepartmental. The press would never see them. But already a few reporters were beginning to suspect that the real reason for the official silence was that there was nothing to report. September 1969. About noon on Monday, September 1st, 1969, 10-year-old Stephen Weiss was fixing the sprinkler on the hill behind his home when he found a gun. Stephen and his parents lived at 3627 Longview Valley Road in Sherman Oaks. Running parallel to Longview, atop the hill, was Beverly Glenn. The gun was lying next to the sprinkler under a bush, about 75 feet, or halfway up the steep hill. Stephen had watched Dragnet on TV. He knew how guns should be handled. Picking it up very carefully by the tip of the barrel so as not to eradicate prints, Stephen took the gun back to his house and showed it to his father, Bernard Weiss. The senior Weiss took one look and called LAPD. Officer Michael Watson, on patrol in the area, responded to the radio call. More than a year later, Stephen would be asked to describe the incident from the witness stand. Question: did you show him, Watson, the gun? Answer: yes. Question: did he touch the gun? Answer: yes. Question: how did he touch it? Answer: with both hands, all over the gun. So much for Dragnet. Officer Watson took the cartridges out of the cylinder. There were 9, 7 empty shell casings and 2 live rounds. The gun itself was a .22 caliber high standard Longhorn revolver. It had dirt on it and rust. The trigger guard was broken, the barrel loose and slightly bent, as if it had been used to hammer something. The gun was also missing the right-hand grip. Officer Watson took the revolver and shells back to Valley Services Division of LAPD, located in Van Nuys, and after booking them as found evidence, turned them over to the property section where they were tagged, placed in manila envelopes, and filed away. Between September 3rd and 5th, LAPD sent out the first batch of confidential flyers on the wanted Tate gun. In addition to a photograph of a high-standard .22 caliber Longhorn revolver and a list of high-standard outlets supplied by Lomax, Deputy Chief Robert Houghton sent a covering letter which asked police to interview anyone who had purchased such a gun and to visually check the weapon to see if the original grips are intact. To avoid leaks to the media, he suggested the following cover story. Such a gun had been recovered with other stolen property, and the police wished to determine its ownership. LAPD sent out approximately 300 of the flyers to various law enforcement agencies in California, other parts of the United States, and Canada. Someone neglected to mail one to the Valley Services Division of the Los Angeles Police Department in Van Nuys. On September 10th, 1 month after the Tate murders, a large advertisement appeared in newspapers in the Los Angeles area. Reward, $25,000. Roman Polanski and friends of the Polanski family offer to pay a $25,000 reward to the person or persons who furnish information leading to the arrest and conviction of the murderer or murderers of Sharon Tate, her unborn child, and the other 4 victims. Information should be sent to Post Office Box 60048, Terminal Annex, Los Angeles, California, 90069. Persons wishing to remain anonymous should provide sufficient means for later identification, one method of which is to tear this newspaper page in half, transmit one half with the information submitted, and save the remaining half for matching up later. In the event more than one person is entitled to the reward will be divided equally between them. In announcing the reward, Peter Sellers, who would put up a portion of the money, together with Warren Beatty, Ewell Brenner, and others, said, "Someone must have knowledge or suspicions they are withholding, or may be afraid to reveal. Someone must have seen the blood-soaked clothing, the knife, the gun, the getaway car. Someone must be able to help." Although unannounced in the press, others had already begun their own unofficial inquiries. Sharon's father, Colonel Paul Tate, had retired from the Army in August. Growing a beard and letting his hair grow long, the former intelligence officer began frequenting the Sunset Strip, hippie pads, and places where drugs were sold, looking for some lead to the killers of his daughter and the others. The police were fearful Colonel Tate's private investigation might become a private war, since there were reports he did not go on his forays unarmed. Nor were the police happy about the reward. Besides the implication that LAPD wasn't capable of solving the case on its own, such an announcement usually yields only crackpot calls, and of these they already had a surplus. Most had come in following the release of Gerritsen, the callers blaming the murders on everyone from the Black Power movement to the Polish secret police, their sources, imagination, hearsay, even Sharon herself, returned during a séance. One wife called the police to accuse her husband. He was evasive as to his whereabouts that night. Hustlers, hairdressers, actors, actresses, psychics, psychotics, all got into the act. The calls revealed not so much the underside of Hollywood as the underside of human nature. The victims were accused of sexual aberrations as peculiar as the minds of the persons who called them in. Complicating LAPD's task were the large number of people, often not anonymous and in some cases very well known, who seemed anxious to implicate their friends, if not directly connecting them with the murders, at least involving them with the drug scene. There were proponents of every possible theory. The Mafia did it. The Mafia couldn't have done it because the killings were so unprofessional. The killings were intentionally unprofessional, so the Mafia wouldn't be suspected. One of the most persistent callers was Steve Brandt, a former gossip columnist. Because he had been a friend of four of the five Tate victims, he had been a witness at Sharon's and Roman's marriage, the police took him seriously at first, Brandt supplying considerable information on Wilson, Pickett, and their associates. But as the calls became more and more frequent, the names more and more prominent, it became obvious that Brandt was obsessed with the murders. Sure, there was a death list and that he was next. Brandt twice attempted suicide. The first time in Los Angeles, a friend arrived in time. The second time in New York, he left a Rolling Stones concert to return to his hotel. When actress Ultraviolet called to make sure he was all right, he told her he had taken sleeping pills. She immediately called the desk man at the hotel, and by the time he reached the room, Brandt was dead. For such a well-publicized crime, there were surprisingly few confessions. It was as if the murders were so horrible that even the chronic confessors didn't want to become involved. A recently convicted felon, anxious to make a deal, did claim another man had bragged of involvement in the killings, but after investigation, the story proved bogus. One after another, leads were checked out, then eliminated, leaving the police no closer to a solution than when the murders were discovered. Though almost forgotten for a time, by mid-September the pair of prescription glasses found near the trunks in the living room of the Tate residence had, simply by the process of attrition, become one of the most important remaining clues. Early that month, the detectives showed the glasses to various optical company representatives. What they learned was in part discouraging. The frames were a popular model, the Manhattan style, readily available, while the prescription lenses were also a stock item, meaning they didn't have to be ground to order. But on the plus side, they also learned several things about the person who had warned them. Their owner was probably a man. He had a small, almost volleyball-shaped head. His eyes were far apart. His left ear was approximately 1/4 to 1/2 inch higher than his right ear, and he was extremely myopic. If he didn't have an extra pair, he would probably have to replace the glasses soon. A partial description of one of the Tate killers? Possibly. It was also possible that the glasses belonged to someone totally unconnected with the crime, or that they had been left behind as a false clue. It was at least something to go on. Another flyer, with the exact specifications of the prescription, was sent to all members of the American Optometric Association, the California Optometric Association, the Los Angeles County Optometric Association, and the ophthalmologists of Southern California, in hopes that it would yield more than had the flyer on the gun. Of the 131 high-standard Longhorn revolvers sold in California, law enforcement agencies had been able to locate and eliminate 105, a surprisingly large percentage, since many of the owners had moved to other jurisdictions. The search continued, but to date it hadn't yielded a single good suspect. A second gun letter was sent to 13 different gun shops in the United States, which, in recent months, had ordered replacement grips for the Longhorn model. Though the replies to this one wouldn't come back until much later, it too drew a blank. Nor were the LaBianca detectives having any better luck. To date, they had given 11 polygraphs. All had been negative. As a result of an MO run through the CII computer, the fingerprints of 140 suspects were checked. A palm print found on a bank deposit slip was checked against 2,150 suspects, and a fingerprint found on the liquor cabinet was checked against a total of 41,034 suspects. All uniformly negative. At the end of September, neither the Tate nor the LaBianca detectives bothered to write up a progress report. October 1969. October 10th. 2 months had passed since the Tate homicides. What is going on behind the scenes in the Los Angeles police investigation, if there is such a thing, of the bizarre murder of Sharon Tate and four others? The Hollywood Citizen News asked in a front-page editorial. Officially, LAPD remained silent, as they had since their last news conference on the case on September 3rd, when Deputy Chief Houghton, while admitting that they still didn't know who had committed the murders, said the detectives had made tremendous progress. Exactly what progress, reporters asked. The pressure was building. The fear remained, if possible even increased, owing to the suggestion, less than subtly hinted at by a popular TV commentator, that perhaps the police were covering for a person or persons prominent in the entertainment industry. Meanwhile, the leaks continued. The media reported that narcotics had been found in several places at the Tate residence, that some of the victims had been on drugs at the time they died. By October, it was also widely reported that the gun sought was a .22, though it was identified as a pistol rather than a revolver, and there was even one TV report, which the police quickly broke silence to deny, that pieces of the gun's grip had been found at the crime scene. The TV station stuck by its information, despite the official denial. A .22 with the broken grip. Several times Bernard Weiss got to wondering about that gun his son Stephen had found. Could it be the Tate murder weapon? But that was ridiculous. After all, the police themselves had the gun, and had it been the weapon, would surely have returned by now to ask more questions and search the hillside. Since turning the weapon over to them on September 1st, Weiss had heard nothing. When there was no follow-up, Stephen had taken it on himself to make a search of the area. He'd found nothing. Still, Beverly Glen wasn't all that far from Cielo Drive, just a couple of miles. But Bernard Weiss had better things to do than play detective. That was LAPD's responsibility. On October 17th, Lieutenant Helder and Deputy Chief Houghton told reporters that they had evidence which, if it could be traced, might lead to the killers, plural, of Sharon Tate and the four others. They refused to be more specific. The press conference had been called in an attempt to relieve some of the pressure on LAPD. No solid information was released, but a number of current rumors were denied. Less than a week later, on October 23rd, LAPD very hastily called another press conference to announce that they had a clue to the identity of the killer, singular, of the five Tate victims, a pair of prescription eyeglasses that had been found at the scene. The announcement was made only because several papers had that same day already printed the wanted flyer on the glasses. Approximately 18,000 eye doctors had received the flyer from their various member associations. In addition, it had been printed verbatim in the Optometric Weekly and the Eye, Ear, Nose, and Throat Monthly, which had a combined national circulation of over 29,000. What was surprising was not that the story had leaked, but that it had taken so long for it to do so. Starved for solid news, the press heralded a major breakthrough in the case, overlooking the obvious fact that the police had had the glasses in their possession since the day the Tate victims were discovered. Lieutenant Helder refused comment when a reporter, obviously with excellent connections inside the department, asked if it was true that to date the glasses flyer had yielded only 7 suspects, all of whom had already been eliminated. It was indicative of the desperation of the Tate detectives that the second and last Tate progress report, prepared the day before the press conference, stated, "At this time, Gerritsen has not been positively eliminated." The Tate report, covering the period September 1st to October 22nd, 1969, ran to 26 pages, most of which were devoted to closing out the cases against Wilson, Pickett, et al. The LaBianca report, closed out on October 15th, was a little shorter, 22 pages, but far more interesting. In one section of the report, the detectives mentioned their use of the CII computer. A MO run on all crimes where the victims were tied is presently being run. Future runs will be made concentrating on the peculiarities of the robberies. Used gloves, wore glasses, or disabled the phone. Robberies. Plural. Wore glasses. Disabled the phone. The phone at the LaBianca residence was not disabled, nor was there evidence that a LaBianca assailant wore glasses. These references were to Tate. The conclusion is inescapable. The LaBianca detectives had decided, on their own and without consulting the Tate detectives, to see if they could solve the Tate as well as the LaBianca case. The second LaBianca report was interesting for still another reason. It listed 11 suspects, the last of whom was one Manson Charles. Part 2. The Killers. You couldn't meet a nicer group of people. Leslie Van Houten, describing the Manson family to Sergeant Michael McGann. At 12 o'clock, a meeting round the table for a seance in the dark, with voices out of nowhere, put on especially by the children for a lark. The Beatles, Cry Baby Cry, White Album. You have to have a real love in your heart to do this for people. Susan Atkins, telling Virginia Graham why she stabbed Sharon Tate. October 15th to 31st, 1969. The physical distance between Parker Center, headquarters of the Los Angeles Police Department, and the Hall of Justice, which houses the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office, is 4 blocks. That distance can be traversed in the time it takes to dial a telephone. But it isn't always that easy. Though LAPD and LASO cooperate on investigations that involve both jurisdictions, there exists between them a certain amount of jealousy. One of the LaBianca detectives would later admit that he and his fellow officers should have checked with LASO homicide detectives in mid-August to see if they had any similar murders. But it wasn't until October 15th, after most of their other leads had evaporated, that they did so. When they did, they learned of the Hinman murder. And unlike Sergeant Buckles of the Tate team, they found the similarities striking enough to merit further investigation. There had been some recent developments in the Hinman case, Sergeants Whiteley and Gunther told them. Less than a week before, Inyo County officers had raided isolated Barker Ranch, located in an extremely rugged, almost inaccessible area south of Death Valley National Monument. The raid, based on charges ranging from grand theft to arson, had netted 24 members of a hippie cult known as the Manson Family. Many of these same people, including their leader, Charles Manson, a 34-year-old ex-con with a long and checkered criminal history, had also been arrested in an earlier raid conducted by LASO, which had occurred on August 16th at Spahn's Movie Ranch in Chatsworth. During the Barker raid, which took place over a 3-day period, two young girls had appeared out of the bushes near a road some miles from the ranch, asking the officers for protection. They claimed they had been attempting to flee the family and were afraid for their lives. One was named Stephanie Schramm, the other Kitty Lutzinger. Whiteley and Gunther had been looking for Kitty Lutzinger ever since learning that she was a girlfriend of Bobby Beausoleil, the suspect in the Hinman murder. Informed of her arrest, they drove 225 miles to Independence, the Inyo County seat, to question her. Kitty, a freckled, frightened 17-year-old, was 5 months pregnant with Beausoleil's child. Though she had lived with the family, she apparently was not trusted by them. When Beausoleil disappeared from Spahn Ranch in early August, no one would tell her where he had gone. Only after several weeks did she learn that he had been arrested, and much later, that he had been charged with the murder of Gary Hinman. Questioned about the murder, Kitty said she had heard that Manson had sent Beausoleil and a girl named Susan Atkins to Hinman's home to get money from him. A fight had ensued, and Hinman had been killed. Kitty couldn't recall who told her this, just that it was the talk at the ranch. She did recall, however, another conversation in which Susan Atkins told her and several other girls that she had been in a fight with a man who had pulled her hair, and that she had stabbed him 3 or 4 times in the legs. Susan Atkins had been arrested in the Barker raid and booked under the name Sadie Mae Glutz. She was still in custody. On October 13th, the day after they talked to Kitty, Sergeants Whiteley and Gunther questioned her. She told them that she and Bobby Beausoleil were sent to Gary Hinman's house to get some money he had supposedly inherited. When he wouldn't give it to them, Beausoleil pulled out a knife and slashed Hinman's face. For 2 days and 2 nights, the pair had taken turns sleeping so Hinman wouldn't escape. Then, on their last evening at the residence, while she was in the kitchen, she had heard Gary say, "Don't, Bobby." Hinman then staggered into the kitchen, bleeding from a chest wound. Even after this, Hinman didn't die. After wiping the house of prints, not effectively, since both a palm print and a fingerprint belonging to Beausoleil were found, they were going out the front door when they heard Hinman moaning. Beausoleil went back in, and she heard Gary cry out, "Oh no, Bobby, please don't." She also heard a sound like gurgling, as when people are dying. Beausoleil then hotwired Hinman's 1965 Volkswagen bus, and they drove back to Spahn Ranch. Whiteley and Gunther asked Susan if she would repeat her statement on tape. She declined. She was transported to the San Dimas Sheriff's Station, where she was booked for suspicion of murder. Susan Atkins' statement, unlike that of Kitty Lutzinger, did not implicate Manson in the Hinman murder. Nor, contrary to what Kitty had said, did Susan admit to having stabbed anyone. Whiteley and Gunther strongly suspected she was telling only what she thought they already knew. Nor were the two LaBianca detectives very impressed. Hinman had been close to the Manson family. Several of its members, including Beausoleil, Atkins, even Manson himself, had lived with him at various times in the past. In short, there was a link. But there was no evidence that Manson or any of his followers knew the LaBiancas or the people at 10,050 Cielo Drive. Still, it was a lead, and they proceeded to check it out. Kitty had been released into the custody of her parents, who had a local address, and they interviewed her there. From LASO, Inyo County officials, Manson's parole officers, and others, they began assembling names, descriptions, and fingerprints of persons known to belong to or associate with the family. Kitty had mentioned that while the family was still living at Spawn, Manson had tried to enlist a motorcycle gang, the Straight Satans, as his personal bodyguard. With the exception of one biker named Danny, the group had laughed at Manson. Danny had stuck around for several months. On learning that the motorcycle gang hung out in Venice, California, the LaBianca detectives asked Venice PD if they could locate a Straight Satan named Danny. Something in Kitty Lutzinger's statement puzzled Whiteley and Gunther. At first they thought it was just a discrepancy, but then they got to wondering. According to Kitty, Susan Atkins had admitted stabbing a man 3 or 4 times in the legs. Gary Hinman hadn't been stabbed in the legs, but Wojtek Frankowski had. Although rebuffed once before, on October 20th, the sheriff's deputies again contacted the Tate detectives at LAPD, telling them what they had learned. It is possible to measure the Tate detectives' interest with some exactness. Not until October 31st, 11 days later, did they interview Kitty Lutzinger. November 1st to 12th, 1969. November was a month for confessions, which, initially, no one believed. After being booked for the Hinman murder, Susan Denise Atkins, a.k.a., police shorthand for also known as, TN means true name, Sadie Mae Glutz, was moved to Sybil Brand Institute, the women's house of detention in Los Angeles. On November 1st, after completing orientation, she was assigned to Dormitory 8000 and given a bunk opposite one Ronnie Howard. Miss Howard, a buxom former call girl who over her 30-some years had been known by more than a dozen and a half aliases, was at present awaiting trial on a charge of forging a prescription. On the same day Susan moved into Dormitory 8000, one Virginia Graham did also. Miss Graham, herself an ex-call girl with a sizable number of AKAs, had been picked up for violating her parole. Although they hadn't seen each other for 5 years, Ronnie and Virginia had not only been friends and business associates in the past, going out on calls together, but Ronnie had married Virginia's ex-husband. As their work assignments, Susan Atkins and Virginia Graham were given jobs as runners, carrying messages for the prison authorities. In the slow periods when there wasn't much work, they would sit on stools in Control, the message center, and talk. At night, after lights out, Ronnie Howard and Susan talked also. Susan loved to talk, and Ronnie and Virginia proved rapt listeners. On November 2nd, 1969, one Steve Zabriskie appeared at the Portland, Oregon Police Department and told Detective Sergeant Richard that a Charlie and a Clem had committed both the Tate and LaBianca murders. He had heard this, the 19-year-old Zabriskie said, from Ed Bailey and Vern Plumley, two hippie types from California whom he had met in Portland. Zabriskie also told Richard that Charlie and Clem were at present in custody in Los Angeles on another charge, grand theft auto. Bailey had told him something else, Zabriskie said, that he had personally seen Charlie shoot a man in the head with a .45 caliber automatic. This had occurred in Death Valley. Sergeant Richard asked Zabriskie if he could prove any of this. Zabriskie admitted he couldn't. However, his brother-in-law, Michael Lloyd Carter, had also been present during the conversations and would back him up if Sergeant Richard wanted to talk to him. Sergeant Richard didn't. Since Zabriskie did not have last names, nor did he have anything concrete to establish that he was telling the truth, Sergeant Richard, according to the official report, did not place any credence on this interview and did not notify the Los Angeles Police Department. The girls in Dormitory 8000 called Sadie Mae Glutz, as Susan Atkins insisted on being known, Crazy Sadie. It wasn't just that ridiculous name. She was much too happy, considering where she was. She would laugh and sing at inappropriate times. Without warning, she would stop whatever she happened to be doing and start go-go dancing. She did her exercises sans underpants. She bragged that she had done everything sexual that could be done, and on more than one occasion propositioned other inmates. Virginia Graham thought she was sort of a little girl lost, putting on a big act so no one would know how frightened she really was. One day, while they were sitting in the message center, Virginia asked her, "What are you in for?" "First-degree murder," Susan matter-of-factly replied. Virginia couldn't believe it. Susan looked so young. In this particular conversation, which apparently took place on November 3rd, Susan said little about the murder itself, only that she felt the co-defendant, a boy who was being held in the county jail, had squealed on her. In questioning Susan, Whiteley and Gunther hadn't told her that it was Kitty Lutzinger who had implicated her, and she presumed the snitch was Bobby Beausoleil. The next day, Susan told Virginia that the man she was accused of killing was named Gary Hinman. She said that she, Bobby, and another girl were involved. The other girl hadn't been charged with the murder, she said, though she had been in Sybil Brand not too long ago on another charge. Right now, she was out on bail and had gone to Wisconsin to get her baby. She was referring to Mary Brunner, first member of the family, who had had a child by Manson. At this time, the police were unaware of her involvement in the Hinman homicide. Virginia asked her, "Well, did you do it?" Susan looked at her and smiled and said, "Sure." Just like that. Only the police had it wrong, she said. They had her holding the man while the boy stabbed him, which was silly, because she couldn't hold a big man like that. It was the other way round. The boy held him, and she had stabbed him 4 or 5 times. What stunned Virginia, she would later say, was that Susan described it just like it was a perfectly natural thing to do every day of the week. Susan's conversations were not limited to murder. Subjects ranged from psychic phenomena to her experiences as a topless dancer in San Francisco. It was while there, she told Virginia, that she met a man, this Charlie. He was the strongest man alive. He had been in prison, but had never been broken. Susan said she followed his orders without question. They all did, all the kids who lived with him. He was their father, their leader, their love. It was Charlie, she said, who had given her the name Sadie Mae Glutz. Virginia remarked that she didn't consider that much of a favor. Charlie was going to lead them to the desert, Susan said. There was a hole in Death Valley, only Charlie knew where it was, but deep down inside, in the center of the earth, there was a whole civilization, and Charlie was going to take the family, the chosen few, and they were going to go to this bottomless pit and live there. Charlie, Susan confided to Virginia, was Jesus Christ. Susan, Virginia decided, was nuts. On the night of Wednesday, November 5th, a young man who might have been able to provide a solution to the Tate-LaBianca homicides ceased to exist. At 7:35 p.m., officers from Venice PD, responding to a telephone call, arrived at 28 Clubhouse Avenue, a house near the beach rented by a Mark Ross. They found a youth, approximate age 22, nickname Zero, true name unknown, lying on a mattress on the floor in the bedroom. Deceased was still warm to the touch. There was blood on the pillow and what appeared to be an entrance wound in the right temple. Next to the body was a leather gun case and an 8-shot, 22 caliber Ivor & Johnson revolver. According to the other persons present, a man and 3 girls, Zero had killed himself while playing Russian roulette. The stories of the witnesses, who identified themselves as Bruce Davis, Linda Baldwin, Sue Bartell, and Catherine Gillies, and who said they had been staying at the house while Ross was away, tallied perfectly. Linda Baldwin stated that she had been lying on the right side of the mattress, Zero on the left side, when Zero noticed the leather case in a stand next to the bed and remarked, "Oh, here's a gun." He removed the gun from the case,